those of you who were with us, you hopefully remember what we've studied so far. We made it down through verse number 12 in this chapter. And 2 Samuel 13 records a very ugly story. It's just a really, really ugly situation. But the thing you want to keep in mind, one thing you want to keep in mind, is that what you read in chapter 13 is the result of things that transpired in chapter 12 and also chapter 11. And what I'm saying is the things that begin to unfold within David's family is the direct result of what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah. God is allowing David to reap the things that he sowed. And that's why you see this really bad stuff begin to take place again in David's life. It's amazing. I think back to all the trouble that David went through with Saul, and there was an awful lot of it, a lot of bad things that he went through. But the Lord got him through all of that situation and brought him to the place where he was king over the entire nation of Israel. He ruled over all of the tribes. And we saw how that God gave him peace and rest from all of his enemies. It was a time of great prosperity and rest in David's life. And he was actually able to go out and advance the kingdom and take back certain things that belonged to Israel. It was just a great time. Everything was going so well in David's life after all of the bad things he had to endure with Saul. And then there he goes and does all that horrible stuff that he did with Bathsheba and Uriah, and everything that was going so smooth and so well and so good has now turned upside down again. And it just shows you how quickly things can change in a person's life by one or two really bad choices. You can literally go from everything just seeming fine and going good and just experiencing the blessing of God in your life to a life that is turned upside down with just one or two bad choices. And that's what happened with David. He was just going along, everything going so well, and then he blew it. Just absolutely blew it. And now, once again, he is neck deep in all kind of trouble, and it's only going to escalate and get worse as we read on from here. Just more and more really bad things, and David's going to find himself right back in the middle of having to run for his life and just try to stay alive. It's just going to get really bad for him. And I do not believe that any of that mess would have ever happened had he not did what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah. Those two choices, those decisions there, is what brought all this mess on. And it starts out with this, well, obviously it started with the loss of the child, that one child, Bathsheba's child dies, and then it just goes from there. It just gets worse. Now you get to chapter 13, and you got this horrible story here of how his firstborn son, Amnon, it says, loved his sister Tamar, and we saw on Sunday night how that was his half-sister, but still, he had no business feeling the way he did for her. And Tamar is the full sister of another of David's sons named Absalom. But the thing you want to keep in mind or remember is when it says that he loved her, this obviously is not a godly love. His affection or his desire toward her is not a godly love. And as we look on tonight and see what happens, you're going to know even more that this wasn't the kind of love that God intends for a man to have toward a woman. And if a man loves a woman the way the Lord intends for him to love a woman, he would never do what Amnon does in this situation right here. So this is not a godly love. It's a sensual type love. It's more of a lust type thing, really, than it is love. But he's so smitten with her that he actually gets sick and begins to lose weight and look bad, so bad that his friend, Jonadab, realizes something's going on. He asks him what the problem is, and Amnon tells him. And then his good buddy here, who is actually his cousin, cooks up this scheme to help Amnon accomplish what he wanted. He says, just get into bed and make yourself sick when your daddy comes to check on you. You tell him you need Tamar to come take care of you. Well, all that happens just that way. David comes to check on Amnon, and he requests Tamar. David, in complete innocence, not thinking anything about it, sends Tamar to take care of Amnon. He goes there. She cooks a meal for him, and he tells her to bring it into the chamber so he could eat it. She goes in, verse number 12, where we left off. Verse 11, you see where he took hold of her and said, "Come lie with me, my sister." And she answered him, "Nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly." She obviously doesn't want this to happen. She realizes it's wrong, it's bad. She don't need anything to do with it. She's trying to convince him that it doesn't need to be done. But at this point, with him, it's a done deal. He's done, made up his mind. He decided what he was going to do if he ever got the chance. And to him, this is his golden opportunity. So he doesn't listen to anything that she says. And in verse 13, it goes on to say, "And I," she's continuing to talk, "whither shall I cause my shame to go?" She's talking about how embarrassed and shamed she would be as a result of what he's intending to do here. And when she says, "Whither shall I cause my shame to go?" the idea is that she'd never be able to get away from the embarrassment, the humiliation of this. "And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel." She's trying to talk some sense into the fellow before he does something really dumb himself, really wicked and really dumb. She says, "Look, I'm going to be shamed and embarrassed. I'll never be able to outlive that. And then on top of that, look what it's going to do to your reputation. People are going to consider you a fool. You're going to be one of the fools in Israel if you do such a thing. Now, therefore, I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee." She says, "Look, don't do what you're intending to do. If you want me that bad, just talk to the king. He'll give me to you to be your wife." Now, I don't believe that would have been a good situation, but I don't think it would have been nearly as awful and bad as what's fixing to happen here. And I think that's her perspective. I don't think she necessarily wants to be Amnon's wife, okay? But she sees what's fixing to happen, understands what's fixing to go on, and she's trying to offer an alternative, something that wouldn't be as horrible as what is fixing to transpire right here in this situation. So that's why she makes the suggestion or gives that idea. But you see in verse number 14, he says, "Howbeit he would not hearken unto her voice." He wouldn't listen. You know why he wouldn't listen? He's done made up his mind. And that's how people are. Once people just make up their mind and decide what they're going to do, it really doesn't matter who says what. Most of the time, they're not going to listen. They're just going to go on and do whatever it is they have decided they're going to do. And so he wouldn't listen to her. But being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her. So he rapes his half-sister is what he does. And I'm not going to go into any detail in that, but all the adults in here, you understand the situation, what happened. It's just a terrible thing. A horrible thing has happened right here. And notice verse number 15, "Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. And Amnon said unto her, Arise, be gone." Notice he immediately changes. There's a complete reversal of the way he felt. Before, he was so smitten and so overwhelmed that he was sick physically, just got to have her. So much so that he's willing to put his reputation on the line, just not thinking right, not thinking clear. And then once he gets what it was he wanted, he then feels completely different. It goes from love to hate. And again, I think you have to consider the way the words are used in this passage right here. Sometimes the word love and hate is used in the Bible differently than we might think of it. I'll give you an illustration of that. When you get over in the New Testament, there's a place where Jesus says that if a man does not hate his mother and father, he cannot be his disciple. Y'all remember reading that in the Bible? That's in there, okay. Jesus said if a man doesn't hate his mother and father, he cannot be his disciple. Now, how many of you in here believe that Jesus wants you to hate your mom and dad in the literal sense of hating them? That's not what he wants, right? Okay, so obviously when he uses that terminology, he's using it, or using that word, he's using it in a different sense, a different way than what we think of the word hate. So hate doesn't always mean what we think it does. It doesn't always mean that you just despise somebody and just hate their guts and want them dead. You know, that's not the way it's used all the time in the Bible. And I think in this chapter right here, the word love and the word hate are used differently than what we think. Like saying that he loved her. Okay, now think about this. If he loved that woman the way God wants a man to love a woman, would he have raped her? He'd have never done that, right? If you love a person, if a man loves a woman in the godly sense, in the way that God intends for a man to love her, he would never violate her that way. So to say that he loved her, obviously it's not love like we normally think of the word. Again, it's more of a lust, an infatuation with somebody, a desire, just got to have that person. And I think, and I'm trying to be careful here, but I think him doing what he did shows you the love he had for her, okay? Because he brings her into that place, and he doesn't say, look, I love you, and I want us to get married, and I want us to be together. Okay, if he loved her in a godly sense, that would have been the approach, right? First of all, I don't think if he loved her in a godly sense, he'd have been loving his sister, all right? But I'm looking beyond that, and I'm saying if he did love her, really love her like a man's supposed to love a woman, he would have said, look, I just want us to get married and I want us to be together. The fact that he did what he did shows the kind of love he had for her, right? It was a lust and a sensual thing. That's the kind of love. So love here, you know, and in other places doesn't necessarily mean love like we think. And I think hate, as it's used here, is the same. When it says in verse 15 that Amnon hated her exceedingly, I don't think it means that he just hated her guts and despised her and never, you know, just wanted her dead. It's not that. It's just showing a complete reversal of the way he had initially felt, where at one point he thought he couldn't live without having her. Now he's had her, and he doesn't want anything else to do with her. He just wants her gone. He got what it was he wanted from her, and now he's through. And that kind of stuff, it's just horrible, but that kind of stuff goes on all the time in the world. People want a certain thing, and when they get it, then they're just done. And it shows you that there's no real love involved in it at all. It's just a wicked thing, a sensual, godless thing, and that's exactly what this was. He got what he wanted. It obviously did not do for him what he thought it would. So now he wants her gone. And that is a really good illustration of all sin. Because sin never satisfies the way people think that it satisfies. It never does. People get in their mind a certain thing that they want, that they desire to have or desire to do, and they believe that if they do that, it's they have this idea in their mind of what it's going to do for them. It's a selfish, self-centered thing. If I do this, then it's going to make me happy. I'm going to be satisfied. I'm going to be fulfilled. My life is going to be so much better if I have this or I do this. And then once they do it, the harsh reality slaps them in the face. That sin never satisfies the way you think it will. In fact, it usually leaves you empty and void on the inside. That's what sin does. But the devil does a really good job, and the flesh does a really good job, and the world does a really good job of deceiving people into thinking that sin will make their life better. But sin never makes your life better, does it? Never. It leaves you hollow and empty and unsatisfied. You know the only life that will truly satisfy anybody? The only life that will truly satisfy is a life lived for the Lord Jesus Christ. That's the only one. Anything that is godless and wicked and sinful is never going to leave you fulfilled or satisfied. It will only leave you empty on the inside. And this is a good illustration of it. Here this fellow, he is so smitten with her that he literally is losing weight every day, thinking he's got to have her. He had her. Now he hates her. We don't have anything to do with her. It obviously did not do for him what he thought it would. And that's the way sin is. But he tells her there in verse 15, get up and get gone. And she said unto him, there is no cause. There's no reason for me to go. There's no reason for you to send me away. She says, this evil in sending me away is greater than the other that thou didst unto me. She's talking about him just compounding things. Because what he's done is a horrible, terrible thing. But now that he's done this, what should he then do? Well, let me show you a passage of Scripture. Hold your place right here and go back to the book of Deuteronomy. You got to remember, this is Old Testament times. The law is in effect. Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse number 28. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse number 28. If a man find a damsel that is a virgin, and that's what she was, y'all remember that? She was a virgin. If a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, she wasn't betrothed to anybody. That betrothed is kind of like engaged. In fact, in the Bible, to be betrothed is it's real strong. It's almost as if you're already married. You're definitely committed to that individual. But if a man find a damsel that is a virgin which is not betrothed and lay hold on her, which is what he did, and lie with her, which is what he did, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he hath humbled her. He may not put her away all his days. Now, according to the Bible, when a man does what this fella did over here, first of all, he should have given 50 shekels of silver to his daddy because that's who her daddy was. But then what should he have done? He should have married her. She should have been his wife, and she was to be his wife for the rest of her life. It says he was not to put her away all his days. So that's, you know, and obviously it would have just been a really weird, messed up thing, okay, because he'd been married to his half-sister. But this whole thing's messed up. The whole story's just one big, gigantic mess, okay? But that's what he should have done. He's not willing to do that. You look back in 2 Samuel 13 and verse 16, into that verse, it says, but he would not hearken unto her. He wouldn't listen. He didn't listen before, and he didn't listen after. He had his mind made up before. He's got his mind made up now. He just wants her gone. So verse 17, then he called his servant that ministered unto him and said, put now this woman out from me and bolt the door after her. I mean, he's adamant. He says, get her out of here, and to make sure she don't come back, bolt the door. Just lock the door. I don't want her back in here. Verse number 18. And she had a garment of divers colors. Divers means different, various. Diverse is very similar. And she had a garment of divers colors upon her. For with such robes were the king's daughters that were virgins apparelled. That's why she had that on, because all of David's daughters that were virgins wore that apparel. Then his servant brought her out and bolted the door after her. Tamar put ashes on her head, which we've seen that before. That was a very common way of expressing grief, sorrow, things of that mourning, to put the ashes on and to rend your clothes, which is why it goes on to say, and rent her garment of divers colors that was on her, and laid her hand on her head and went on crying. She just goes away. She's obviously just very distraught and tore up about what's happened, because it's a terrible, horrible thing that has happened here in her life. And any time something like that happens in a woman's life, it's a horrible, terrible thing. And it's just a bad thing that absolutely should be punished. There's no doubt about it. Verse number 20 says, "And Absalom, her brother, said unto her, Hath Amnon thy brother been with thee?" Now, when he says been with thee, he don't mean like y'all been hanging out. Y'all know what he means, right? Okay. Obviously, somehow he figures this thing out. Maybe because of the way she looks when she comes back, but he figures this thing out. But he tells her, "Hold now thy peace, my sister. He is thy brother." It's like he's family. Just don't say nothing. Just keep your mouth shut. He says, "Regard not this thing." So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. Now here's the thing. You wonder, why would he tell her to keep quiet? Why wouldn't he, you know, say, "Let's bring this out and let's deal with this thing"? Maybe one thing he's thinking about is the embarrassment it would bring on the family. But in my mind, he's already decided what he's going to do. He when he finds out what Amnon has done to his sister, he has decided right now, you just be quiet. Let Big Brother take care of it. And that's exactly what Big Brother's going to do. He's going to take care of it. Verse 21, "But when King David heard of all these things, he was very wroth." So somehow David finds out about it. And he gets very angry, very mad. And rightly so. It's a terrible thing that's going on in his family. But to me, the one he really ought to be mad with is himself. He ought to be mad with himself, because he's the one that's really responsible for all this mess that's going on. I know each one of these people had their own choice to make. But, again, the reason this stuff's unfolding in his life and in his family is because of what he did. Okay. So if he's going to be mad at anybody, he ought to be mad at himself for what he did. "And Absalom spake unto his brother Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar." Says he didn't speak to him good or bad. That means he just didn't talk to him. He didn't say anything good. He didn't say anything. He just left the guy alone because he hated him. That use of the word hate there is probably in the literal sense. He probably literally hated him because of what he did to his sister. Verse 23, "And it came to pass after 2 full years, so some time goes by, 2 years go by, that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons." Now, whenever these people would have these times where they sheared sheep, or at the time of harvest would be another example, they generally had some type of celebration, some type of festival. They just eat, have a big feast and fellowship, just have a really good time. So they're shearing their sheep, and Absalom decides this is the time when I'm going to do what I need to do. And he uses this time, which was normally a celebration, to kind of set his plan in motion. He invites all the king's sons to the celebration. Verse 24, "And Absalom came to the king and said, Behold, now thy servant hath sheep shearers. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servant." He invites his daddy and his servants to come along. And you wonder why he would invite them, knowing what he had planned to do. Well, in inviting his daddy, he probably knew his daddy wasn't going to come and bring all his servants to this. But inviting him, it makes it seem like he's up to nothing bad, right? Just and inviting his daddy to come along would make David think, okay, just having a good time, just wanting my sons to come be a part of it. It wouldn't make David think he was up to anything, okay? Verse 25, and the king said to Absalom, "Nay, my son, let us not all now go, lest we be chargeable unto thee." And he pressed him. Howbeit, he would not go, but blessed him. He just kept on trying to get him to come, kind of, he wouldn't come. So he just sent him away with his blessing, is the idea. Then said Absalom, "If not, I pray thee, let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said unto him, "Why should he go with thee?" And Absalom pressed him that he let Amnon and all the king's son go with him. So he finally says, "All right, all the boys can go. Y'all take off. Have a good time." David may have thought when he asked for Amnon to come that something was up, but I think the fact that he had waited 2 full years kind of made David think that maybe Absalom had put all that behind him and wasn't going to do nothing about it, which is, to me, that's why, you know, you wonder why would he wait 2 years to do what he did. I think it was just all one big plan that he came up with in his mind, you know, wait a couple of years, let everything kind of cool down, everybody sort of forget about what happened, and then I'll do what I need to do. And so the king lets all the boys go. Verse 28, now Absalom had commanded his servant, saying, "Mark ye now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him, fear not. Have not I commanded you, be courageous and be valiant?" So he's got his servants watching. He says, whenever his heart is merry with wine, which means what? When he gets drunk, okay, then you kill him. That's right. When he gets drunk, you kill him. Don't be afraid. I've commanded you. This is my orders to you. Just be courageous, be valiant. And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, every man got him up upon his mule and fled. So when that happens, all the rest of them get up and they get out of there. Maybe they thought, well, he killed him. He may going to kill all of us. Let's leave. I don't know what they thought, but they were obviously fearful and wanting to get away. They got up on their mule and fled. To be honest with you, if I'd have been there, I'd have wanted something beside a mule to ride. I'd have wanted something that would have moved a little faster than a mule. Unless it was one of these mules that they have now, it's got a motor on it, you know. That might have worked all right. And it came to pass while they were in the way that tidings came to David, saying, "Absalom hath slain all the king's sons, and there is not one of them left." That is amazing to me right there. That same thing, very much of what you see happening now, is not new. In fact, the Bible says there's nothing new under the sun, doesn't it? Nothing new under the sun. And most of the things that you see, the behavior within people and that sort of thing, most of that goes on now, you can look back and find some precedent for that in the Word of God. You can find somebody thousands of years ago that did some of the very same things. The difference, I think, is maybe they didn't have the technology at their disposal that people have now, so it might have went about differently. But the same kind of stuff happens today as happened back then, or it happened back then just like it happens now. Like this thing here, one son got killed. One son gets killed. But what do the people tell David? Tell him that every one of his children got killed. Isn't that the way it is? Y'all seen that stuff happen before, something bad happened or whatever, and words and stories start getting out about it, and about 95% of it is not even close to what actually happened. People just blow the thing up and they tell all this happening, you know. And then when you finally do wade through all of the mess and all the stuff that's said and get to the actual truth of what happened, many times what happened doesn't even resemble what people said happened. And it's bad. It's really bad when social media is used for that kind of stuff. And it happens a lot. Just stories get put out there, and it's not even close to the truth. And can you imagine how David felt here, hearing that every one of his boys got killed? And it wasn't even true. Then the king arose and tear his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants stood by with their clothes rent. And Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, and we saw that fella early in the chapter. He's the one that was subtle and talked Amnon, or told Amnon what to do to do this. Answered and said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment of Absalom, this hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar." Now, Jonadab wasn't there, so how would he know? I think one of two things. Either he just put two and two together and figured what happened here, or something different there. He may have just thought, or maybe Absalom had talked to him about it. Maybe him and Absalom had a conversation somewhere in private, and Absalom told him what he was going to do. I don't know, but he's figured it out. But he says there at the end of that verse, he said, this was appointed of Absalom. Look at this. For by the appointment of Absalom, this hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. He made up his mind that day. I don't know that he necessarily knew right then how he was going to do all of it, but he made up his mind that day when he heard about it that sometime, somewhere, somehow, Amnon was going to pay for what he did to his sister. And he did. He killed him. Now, we're going to stop here for time, but I do want to remind you of something else. Back in the previous chapter when David's confronted by Nathan about this, remember, Nathan told him that little story about the man taking the sheep